You're listening to The Watchers, a show where two women from opposite ends of New Jersey watch movies and TV about New Jersey.
About fucking Jersey.
I'm Andrea.
I'm Jody. I'm going to curse a lot this episode.
I was just going to say about fucking jerseys, right?
I've already said fucking like 17 times while we've been chatting, getting ready to do this.
Yeah.
There's something about this, like, this Jersey vibe. I can't not do it.
Totally. You know, we're only a year into the show, and half of it has been spent on Yellow Jackets, and neither one of us came into this having watched much of or remembering much of what we've watched of the, Sopranos. But at the same time, it also kind of feels like, well, it's about fucking time.
Like, I know.
We had to do this, right?
I know. And I feel like, okay, so I need you to give me a moment up top for a little speech that I have not prepared, but I've been wanting to make before we talk about this episode. Number one, I think I watched this whole show.
Oh.
I have a terrible memory, but as I, like, notoriously terrible memory, things go out of my brain as soon as I'm done with them. But as I was doing research for our episode, I was like looking at later seasons and the storylines and all of that. And enough of it lives in my brain that I was like, this isn't just like my general pop culture knowledge. I did actually watch this show. I do, however, want to issue an apology to a precursor apology to any of our listeners that are our New Jersey is the World friends or are from New Jersey, because I know how important this show is to so many of our dear friends. And it is not, it's important to me in some ways because of the Jersey of it all.
Right, the fact of its existence is important.
It's important to me, sure. And like I was telling you earlier, I got all excited when I started thinking about all the locations. But I realized something last night when I was watching the pilot again. This show came out in 1989, which is the year I left New Jersey for New York City. And it ended in 2007, at which point I had moved even further away to Rhode Island. And many people who grew up in New Jersey know that there is some trauma associated with our childhoods, generally, just as being a part of this weird place. And I was in the phase of my life when this show was very popular that I was trying to put my Jersey life behind me and like become an adult somewhere new. I had kind of like cut ties with that part of my personality and my like existence. And it took me a long time to kind of come back around and embrace that. And so that's the other reason I think that this was like, I was like, yeah, fucking Jersey. I know.
Right.
I know. I just left.
Right.
Come on. I need a break. So anyway, I needed to stipulate up top that I hope people don't hate us after this episode. That's all I'm going to say.
I mean, maybe they'll hate you. I don't think they're going to hate me. I liked it, but
yeah. I like it too. I mean, I watched it.
I think I said this a little bit last week. I have put this, Sopranos. I thought everybody was calling it the Sopranos the way that we just sometimes decide to say things a little different. Do you know what I mean? And like people, but it's like, I don't know why I thought that was 100% the case and that people saying the Sopranos were right. Cause that's how you know, but
I have always said the Sopranos. I can't say it the other way. I'm sorry.
I feel
like wrong.
Most people do. And that's why I thought Soprano was like people trying to be a little like
fancy,
especially with like an Italian last name.
Yeah.
You know how like this is such a total. Oh my God. This could not be more of a side note. I'm so sorry. Well, I mean, if we're talking The Sopranos, we're talking Italian names, we're talking pronunciations. Total side note. But 2 weeks ago, the Sporkful came through Philly, and I was their like on-site audio engineer. I don't work for that show. They just needed somebody, and I know some we have some folks in common. And I say that because if you know the Sporkful, Dan Pashman invented a new pasta shape.
Yes, he did.
And it's called cascatelli.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I don't remember actually now if it was in the research for it or in the actual recording of the episode, and it's not out yet, so I can't double check. But it's called cascatelli, which means waterfalls. And apparently the actual word for waterfalls in Italian is cascatelle, or like the feminine version of it, which the pasta should be, whatever, something like that. And he was like, oh, I took some poetic license and added the I at the end because Cascatelli sounds more Italian and it sounds more like a pasta name. And I was thinking, like, yeah, but in Jersey, we're just going to call it, like, Cascatelle anyway. Yeah. So you can call it whatever you want, but that's Cascatelle.
Yeah. Mozzarella.
So, yeah, exactly. So whatever. Whatever, man.
Yeah.
Call whatever you want, Dan Pashman.
That's very true. That's very true.
Such a side note, but there's so much. I said to you before we even get into it, I was like 10 minutes into the episode and I texted you. I was like, we should have made bingo cards for this.
I know.
There's a Shoyadel. There's a Gabagool. Like,
I know. I know. Oh my God. And it's so funny. Like I feel like I'm like admitting something terrible. I have no Italian background. I am from a very Italian part of New Jersey. Like I'm from a very like blue collar Italian town that is no longer as Italian as it used to be. But when I grew up, we've talked about this before, like a lot of my friends were super Italian, but I have no Italian genetics. And I feel like apologizing for that right now.
Yeah, I mean, neither do I. I think I would have assumed that you did if I didn't know that already. Like, none. That feels... But in the same way, this is going to really annoy Italians who aren't from Jersey. This might annoy any Italian listener. But in the same way that on St. Patrick's Day, everybody's a little Irish.
Yeah.
In New Jersey, everyone's a little Italian.
Well, and that's like a Chris... Well, it took 3 seconds for us to get to Chris Gethard. But, like, that's the Taylor Ham, Egg, and Cheese special that he did. Mm-hmm. He has a whole bit about how everyone in New Jersey is a little bit Irish, a little bit Italian, and a little bit Jewish because, like, we're just on top of each other and the culture is so overwhelmingly there.
And I know it is problematic of me. It's like borderline, well, I have Italian friends of me to say, but, like, I really spent more holiday dinners in homes of Jewish and Italian families than in my own. Like, 100% I have had more... like seven fish Italian dinners than any other holiday dinner I've spent, you know, so it's just in there.
Yeah. And my best friend, I'm doing it too. I have some Italian friends. My best friend and her husband are extremely Italian.
Yeah,
one
exactly.
from Long Island and one from Rhode Island.
It's hard not to appropriate the culture to some degree.
I know. So. I know. Well, there's that bit, I forget who it is, that like the last remaining acceptable racism is against Italians.
It's Pete Holmes.
That's right. Yeah. I couldn't remember.
It's a good bit. It's a really good bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So like all that to say, I was worried last week when I first rewatched this that I was going to make some real enemies, that this was going to be like my villain arc. But after doing more research, it got me. Like, I have such an affection for the people involved in the show and for its, like, commitment to how fucking Jersey it is that, like, I can't.
It's also, objectively, I think think it's good.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, it's definitely good.
It's hard for me. I'm a little more, I'm not squeamish isn't the right word, but I'm a little more squeamish about violence in general than I used to be. I've definitely, you know, some of my favorite movies and shows are very violent. It's just become harder and harder to tap into that part.
We've talked about how when I was a kid, I was more into horror movies than I am now. Mm-hmm. Like, and I wasn't ever so into them, but I was certainly okay with them. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten more and more sensitized to violence as I've gotten older. And last night I was thinking to myself, why is it? Because I knew we were going to talk about the fact that the sort of violence in this episode and the violence that continues in this show, as I, you know, remembered, makes it very hard for me to watch. It is the thing that takes me out of it. But why? We're watching a show where girls cannibalize each other, right?
And yeah, the gore factor of even just oh God, I'm all over the place today. The compound fracture of somebody's leg. There's one in this episode.
I know.
It is much less gory.
Yep.
It's not that great. The violence in this movie or in this episode, especially compared to I'm thinking of Casino.
Yeah.
Like, it's nothing compared to those.
Yeah.
But it is, I think it's just the matter of factness of it, right?
And I think so. For me, I think what I came to was the reason that I can deal with Yellow Jackets and this was hard. Actually has to, this is you sent me a text that was it'll be half joking, it'll be a feminist take on The Sopranos in 2024. And I was like, who the fuck wants that in my head? But actually, I think the reason this is harder for me than Yellow Jackets is because in Yellow Jackets, it's women doing the violence.
And that's kind of cool. And we kind of like that. And it's not, it doesn't feel as threatening.
Well, like, that's exactly the thing. So we've talked repeatedly about how.
Or as possible. Here's the other thing. Not to whatever. You and I don't have mob ties, certainly.
No.
But this feels much more realistic and much more like at home than a bunch of like soccer girls in the 90s cutting each other up in the woods. Like,
yeah,
it's just...
I will incessantly talk about the locations and how close they are to where I grew up. But
it feels more real.
It is like, as a female identified person growing up in the United States, I feel the threat of violence from men on a daily basis. Like, I'm aware of it on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And so I think even though the men are mostly beating each other up, there is violence against women in The Sopranos later on. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of sense that that's happened or possible based on the way they treat the women in their lives.
Totally.
I think that I am much more happy to see teenage girls on the same societal level as each other, like physically murder and dismember each other, than I am willing to see an older white guy who looks like everyone I grew up with beat the shit out of someone. Like, that is a little, I think it's just very close to home, like in terms of the actual possibility of that happening in our lives.
Right. And Yellow Jackets, it's so like, imagine the lengths these women had to go to and where they were pushed to, and whether or not, you know, some of them, this isn't a Yellow Jackets episode, but, you know, some of them were maybe waiting for an excuse to tap into their darker urges.
Absolutely.
But it's also the matter of factness of it all in a way that, like, the part of me that watches this with a less critical feminist eye is kind of tickled by. Mm-hmm. Like, Tony chasing that man around in his car is, it just is funny. And the lightness that he treats it with and, like,
the music.
Yeah, like, that's really, like, I was kind of tickled by that. But it is also just, he's so desensitized to it that it's a little like,
yeah.
That's hard.
It is. It's like, and I think that part of my reaction to this show and my awareness that a lot of my male friends, like, were fully obsessed with it has to do with that making me uncomfortable. Like, the fact this, I'm going to try to explain this. The fact that male people in my life, male friends, were obsessed with this show that shows so much violence and violence towards women and were idolizing and turning into a hero, Tony Soprano.
Well, it's the Breaking Bad of it all, too. These, like, people watching these shows. I mean, I think Tony is a little more loved in his own show than Walter is supposed to be in Breaking Bad. Yeah. But it's still like, so 1999 to 2007, again, I was 13 to 21. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the quote unquote men in my life were teenage boys.
Yeah.
And they were, again, also obsessed. And it
fucking
was like
terrifying also.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just like, half the kids, I could name them right now. Some of them married people, like, turned into little South Jersey mobster, like, wannabe mobsters. They all suddenly had this, like, North Jersey, really, Italian accent that they all picked up from Tony, which I learned, I don't think I said this while we were recording yet, apparently the accent he does in this episode is subtle compared to what happens when the series kicks off, and I can't believe that is incredible.
The accents in this show are just wild.
I mean I love it, but
not inaccurate, like, right. I mean, we know people whose family members sound like Colonel Soprano.
So, like, you know,
the
way they kind of held Tony up as a real hero when Tony clearly doesn't think of himself that way, like, is troublesome. So
I think that's what I'm coming down, this the reason that I'm coming to for my discomfort with it is not just the depiction of violence, because, like, whatever, this is our culture in America, but it's the devotion to this show and Tony Soprano specifically, of the men in my life at the time, some of whom had violent tendencies,
right
like, you know, this is all we've talked about before, how like we want to look at this as entertainment and how, you know, some of the stuff is all fun and games on television. But like when you have a male friend who decides out of nowhere that he's in love with you, and when you're not in love with him, starts like putting his foot through pool tables and throwing shit at walls, like,
right.
This feels a little more like, oh yeah, no, I know this. Mm-hmm. I know this feeling
of
this type of violence just being under the surface at all times. So all that to say, like, I was worried about doing this episode, and now I'm a lot less worried because I do have so much love and respect for the love and respect this show has for Jersey.
Totally.
Just a few things, like a little background. So you said the series was on from 99, beginning of 99. Actually, you know what I realized? This show started right when I started my first job out of college. Aww. Like maybe to the week.
Funny.
And went when to 2007.
When did it premiere?
January 10th, 99.
Just, yeah, right before my 13th birthday.
Oh my God. And I was my little like young professional New York City version of myself. Written and created by David Chase, known before that for Rockford Files, Northern Exposure, and something called Almost Grown. This episode was directed by David Chase. The only other one he directed was the finale.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. It was shot a year and a half before it aired on HBO, which you and I were talking off mic about little baby James Gandolfini in this episode.
I'm almost 2 years older than he was. Little tiny boy. At this point. Yeah.
Just 38 a little years guy. Old. Just a little guy. There's two people in this that end up being played by different actors later on because it was shot so much later.
I did see that, yeah.
Yeah. But
yeah, this is like a pilot in the real true sense where it's like they're still figuring out different roles. And like I was reading that's where's my, I'm not even gonna Jersey reference air horror this episode, obviously, but if I had to pick the Jerseyest reference in here, I think it's little Stevie playing Silvio.
Like, sure, yes.
Yeah, Steve Van Zandt from Bruce Springsteen, Me Street Band, obviously.
Yeah. I thought about like, this whole episode is a Jersey reference. Like there is no, we can't do that. We'd be here.
But I was reading that like his role is very different in the pilot, and he's like a much more involved member later, that kind of thing. I really that's one of the things I think is really interesting about pilots is like this is what we thought it was going to be, and then you know, when we went back to the writer's room or whatever, got our notes or whatever, like here are the things that shifted.
Well, apparently I'm looking at this article by Alan Sepinwall.
Jersey reference.
Yeah.
Just Alan Sepinwall, Star Ledger.
Yeah. He fought to direct the pilot in part because he was hoping HBO would lose interest and he could expand it into a feature film that would get him out of the TV business forever.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. That's hilarious.
Well, because originally this was pitched for like Fox or something and they turned it down and HBO picked it up.
Well,
it was supposed to be more of a... So this is, I don't know if you read this. This was super fascinating. It's the same article by Alan Sepinwall. He reported that David Chase once toyed with the idea of playing The Sopranos as a broad farcical comedy, sort of like The Simpsons. But once Gandolfini read for the part of Tony, Chase understood that the show can be absurdist. It can have a lot of stupid shit in it, but it should not be a live action Sopranos.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
Live action Simpsons. So something more like My Blue Heaven than Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
But James Gandolfini was just so fucking good at Tony.
He is good. It feels really real. You know what I didn't know about Tony? About James Gandolfini's death? That he died in Rome?
Yeah.
I didn't know that part. I knew, I forgot. But I knew that it was a heart attack, that he was young, that it was pretty like, you know, Tony Soprano of him.
Oh, I'm not going to stop calling him Soprano. I'm sorry. But yeah, no, he was only 51 years old.
Yeah, it's
which
sad.
Is younger than I remembered him being.
Yeah,
really fucking tragic. I mean, like, we don't have to go into James Gandolfini's personal life too much in this episode, but he definitely had a complicated life. mm-hmm. a life that had some addiction in it, that had some sort of like difficulties. But every person, 201 on that set, talks about him with so much love. So much love.
Well, even just, I can't remember whose story this is. Is it someone we know? This is the Jersey of it all. That I'm like, is it somebody we literally know or just some Jersey celebrity that I've heard tell this story? But that there's like a story about him being at a local like bar or restaurant, just there, like hanging out and being just the nicest, coolest guy.
I think this was a New Jersey is the World episode. I think it was a caller.
Is it a caller?
On like a Gagoots or something that was talking that about right. running into him. Or it was a different Jersey is a World episode. But I remember right. that too. He definitely was apparently difficult sometimes.
Well, but who isn't?
Yeah. Yeah.
What I'm such a sucker for is the curmudgeon with a heart of gold, is the tough exterior.
It's a fucking Jersey dad, man.
It's so, that's what it is. It's like, this isn't just it doesn't feel like this isn't, and some of it is that like all of the dads in Jersey, a little bit of them wants to be Tony Soprano. So, but it's like, he doesn't just feel like, oh, this is what a mafia don would be. It's like, this is every dad I grew up with feels like this to some degree. When he's at the grill and he's like, cook, it'll make you feel better, to his like buddy who owns a restaurant. Like, it just is.
Even my dad, who was like as far from this as you can possibly imagine ways.
I mean, mine too.
But
he was literally a cop. So I mean, literally.
Yeah.
But also just like a very subtle, not uninvolved. What's the word? Unbothered
Reserved.
Kind of
yeah.
guy.
Oh, yeah,
Reserved
yeah.
is exactly the word. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I remember I had male friends that were afraid of my dad because mm-hmm. my dad was so quiet.
Right. Right.
And had like, he just had a threatening vibe to them when he was like a puppy. Like, he was the sweetest man in the world, but he didn't talk
right
like to anyone other than us. And so mm-hmm. like, and he had these big like Ted Bundy glasses, like
oh, mine too.
Yeah. So all that to say, Tony Soprano, Jersey fucking dad, like uh-huh. you know, loves his kids, a little gruff, like very busy, not home a lot, leaves a lot to the mom,
mm-hmm.
but then steps in and like interferes when he wants.
He feels in a show that like you would think maybe not, he feels really real for sure. Mm-hmm. And not everybody in this episode does, but he definitely does. So does Carmella.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meadow, I hope. I mean, Jamie Lynn Siegler, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like she gets it together eventually. We've got to give young actors a little patience.
Mm-hmm.
But
she definitely does.
That's
she definitely does. Yeah. And it's so funny. Like, I was watching old clips after watching the pilot, and I forgot, like, how young the actor that plays AJ was at the beginning.
He's like a kid, right?
But it's like a 10-year stretch of his life. So, you know, he starts
That's
at like 12 years old, and he's in his young 20s when the show ends.
Like a little adult.
I don't know. Point. Yeah. So I took notes for this more like I've taken notes for Yellow Jackets, because I was kind of like, I wrote everything down because I was
Me
just
too.
So interested in the structure of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one thing I noticed when we do this for Yellow Jackets, I kind of break things down by scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, you know, maybe 10 to 15 scenes in the whole hour-long show.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how many times this flips scenes from one place to another?
Is it a lot? It's a lot.
33.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And it's only one timeline. And it's only a few locations, but mm-hmm. it's constantly jumping around in a way that's sort of like, it's interesting because part of it is seen through his conversation with Dr. Melfi, but also mm-hmm. like things are happening outside of that. It's like the main locations are the office, Tony's house, the office park, which we'll talk about, Sintani's meat market, which is a real place in Elizabeth, Artie's restaurant, Tony's mom's house, the hospital, the nursing home briefly, the Bada Bing, Satin Dolls, excuse me. the Falls. I forgot that the Falls is in this episode. It's like, ah. Oh.
I was watching it with my housemate who is not from Jersey and just being like, huh? Look at that. You didn't know Jersey had that, did you? Just like.
I know. Somehow on TikTok the other day, I got fed a video of some girl being like, I've lived in Jersey for 4 years and I didn't know we had this. And she's like at the falls. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, we're the best.
It's very cool. Anyway.
Yeah, you so people who are from Jersey who don't love Jersey have just never left your front fucking yard because we have everything.
Yes. So there's a lot of different locations, but they're each visited multiple times too. So.
Yeah, it does feel, it really feels very lived in and like just a day in the life of Tony Soprano.
Mm-hmm.
Like.
Or a few, but yeah.
Yeah.
Can we talk first quickly about the opening credits? Because it's so iconic. I think we have to not miss that.
Yeah, of course. I will say, I don't love the theme song. I'm guessing that like people who watch this show from the beginning do. Yeah, it feels, I don't know what I want it to be. But I'm not crazy about the theme song. I love the credits themselves.
Yeah.
It feels great. I'm sure for you, it feels even better.
I just can't, I guess I can't imagine it without it.
Right, like, that makes sense.
It's so part of it for me, but. Yeah, so I found a funny, because I was like, I'm such a, this is like one of my special interests is like geography and maps. And I'm like, this isn't right. What is he doing? And I found someone else that also feels this way. And it was Alan Sepinwall. he talks about the opening credits and he says, the route he takes to get there makes no sense. If he's going directly home as he winds his way all around the Meadowlands over by the Holland Tunnel and into various parts of Hudson, Passaic, and Essex counties. If, on the other hand, the credits are meant to reflect a day where he's stopping by various family-affiliated businesses along the way, the sanitation company, for instance, is located in the shadow of the Pulaski Skyway, then I can see it, even if I spend the start of every episode yelling at him just to hop on Route 3 West.
Okay, but like, Alan, Jody, haven't you ever had a day where you get done work and you just need 10 to 12 hours of you alone in your car before you're ready to go home?
Of course, but this is the start of every fucking episode. So it's implied that this is his route every day. Right. And it's like, you would not. So anyway, yeah. And I will say most of the locations in the opening are between New York City and like West Caldwell, which is where the house was. And it goes through parts of Jersey that I am not unfamiliar with, but just spent less time in than some of the other locations that they get to. But a lot of it's in Elizabeth. They go through Kearney.
Famously a show that doesn't travel much into South Jersey. South Jersey has their own mafia stuff going on. Anyway, but so the locations themselves were not like personally was significant to me, but just the fact of them being Jersey, of course. When we do our full episode by episode rewatch of The Sopranos, then the Pine Barrens episode will obviously be important to me, but that's going to be it'll be a little while before we get there.
Yeah. No, trust me. I texted you last night. I was like, can we just keep watching Six Feet Under? Because I already gone through the whole first season now that we did the pilot. Wow. I watched the entire first season again. But so Santani's meat market is in Elizabeth. Vesuvio, that restaurant that gets blown up at the end of the episode is also in Elizabeth. His mom's house is in, I want to say Verona. Yeah, Verona. So, like, I went to college at Montclair State, which is in that, like, that part of my life was in that area. But not that anyone cares, but.
Well, we're in the world building section of.
Yeah.
Of our review.
Yeah.
And I would say it is a fully realized, specific.
Yeah.
What's realistic world, for sure.
Yeah. And.
In with it, the everything is on location.
Yeah. And with the exception of the intro opening, it does make sense where the other things are. Like, his house is technically in West Caldwell. His mom's house is in Verona. The retirement home they look at is in West Orange. Like, it makes sense where they're going. Elizabeth, like, all of those places.
I don't remember
Great Falls.
If you said this outright or if I'm just remembering this as something you would have probably said, even if you didn't. that the first episode of Yellow Jackets, when they do that montage that places them a little mm-hmm. further south, we think, than this, is like, is it impossible for you to watch that and not think of The Sopranos?
Yeah, definitely. Opening credits? Yeah, that I might have. I think I said that when we talked about the pilot, but if I didn't, I definitely think that when I see that montage, because it's like the kind of coming in from the city into mm-hmm. Jersey proper, just from a different point of view.
Right.
I also, because I mean, so in terms of world building, I mean, this episode fucking, to me, nails it. Like, yeah, it's totally. Not just that it feels, because so much is shot on location, that it feels really in its place. Like, it feels very grounded in this part of Jersey. But also from a practical perspective, we get to see most of the significant locations that are going to be repeating throughout the series mm-hmm. in this first episode. It's establishing so, so much without feeling overkill about it.
That's how it feels to me as someone who's never seen, again, any of the show except for the Many Saints of Newark and part of the Pine Barrens episode, is that they introduce you to a lot, but in a way that doesn't feel too overwhelming.
Right.
And in a way that it does feel like you're just thrown into the middle of this and you've kind of got to pick up like what's going on with the different families and where they're at. And like, mm-hmm. and Tony does, in those little bits of like kind of voice over, give you a little bit of that. And when he's talking to Dr. Melfi, like, mm-hmm. You know, a lot of Dr. Melfi is to give you the exposition. I think that's really clever. It's a way to do it where it doesn't feel too like you're being hit over the head.
Especially because he's telling her one thing and we're seeing what actually happened. So and fun. So that's kind of like you see him censoring himself.
Right. That felt very My Blue Heaven to me when she's like, I forget exactly what she says, but it's like, theoretically, she's like, I'd have to tell. And so he's like, we had coffee.
Yeah.
We're like, there's another
one. I love her face when he says he's in waste management consulting. She's like, Okay,
it's
sir.
Perfect.
Okay,
it's,
sir.
He's in the exact, of course, I mean, of course he is in the exact right job, because they're not trying to, like, it's not mafia shifted a little bit for entertainment. It's like,
no.
David Chase is like, what would he be in real life? It would be fucking waste management, of course.
Yep.
And everybody knows.
Yeah, exactly. So the main locations, I think, that we see that are established, that we repeat throughout the series, are his house, obviously, becomes mm-hmm. such a huge sort of like centerpiece.
Right. Well, even I know, like, him walking up that driveway to get his newspaper is...
Apparently, and I didn't remember this, him getting the newspaper from the driveway happens in almost the first episode in almost every season.
Fun.
He goes and walks down and gets the newspaper, the Star Ledger, of course.
That made me so happy.
Yeah. Apparently the production worked with the Star Ledger to get reproductions of actual papers from those times.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's really fun.
So there's the house. There's obviously Dr. Melfi's office is like a huge piece.
Which, I'm sorry, that office, I don't need my therapist's office to look like that. It's like a little unsettling to me. Yeah, like, it is like,
why is it round?
It's so, but it does remind me, and I think I said the same thing about her office, of the therapist in Yellow Jackets. These are not the kind of offices I want my therapist, like, this is not the vibe I want being established when I'm talking to my therapist.
It feels like a stage.
Yeah
You know, mm-hmm. and when he walks in and doesn't know where to sit, like, mm-hmm. Yeah. Other locations that we see that repeat. So Santani's appeared in the first episode, but it's an actual business. And apparently they could not balance their actual very productive, busy business with filming. And so they created a different version of this, like,
fun.
In a empty storefront. But in the first episode, it's actually at Santani's, which is a very, very well loved and extremely good meat market in Elizabeth, apparently. Artie's restaurant disappears because it gets blown up. That's a one-off.
That storyline, I love so much.
Yeah, there's a few things that don't reappear, really, I think. One of them is his mom's house. Because shortly after this, there's some stuff that's going to happen with his mom not being able to live alone for much longer. She's already bringing up the nursing home in this first episode, mm-hmm. so you can kind of tell that that's where that's going.
She's such a, that she's another one who feels so real to me. Everything about it. When she's like, I know we're doing this totally out of order. I'm so sorry. I'll save it.
We'll no, it's okay. She makes me so uncomfortable.
Yeah. But in a way that I kind of, part of her makes me so uncomfortable. Part of her is like, when she's like, I made some eggplant or whatever. And he's like, I already ate lunch. I'm like, Tony, save your breath, man.
You got to eat the eggplant.
You're going to eat the fucking eggplant. She doesn't give a shit.
She makes me uncomfortable because she's so fucking real.
Yeah, totally.
Like, David Chase has said that, like, the mob part of this, like, he was interested in, but he really wanted to make a show about a guy and his mom and their relationship and, like, the sort of toxic nature of it and everything because, I guess, of his own family. Unfortunately, the actor that played his mom died in the second season. Like, oh, for real in life.
Right.
She was older, obviously.
Yeah, I was looking at her, her history. She's, like... She was around forever and won
she's
a bunch
born in
of awards and it's like a big, yeah.
Yeah. So she's passed great. Away like in the second season of the show.
Olivia.
Yeah. So then another location, obviously, that comes back many, many times is the Bada Bing.
Mm-hmm.
Which, meh. I think that was another part of it that I was like, I don't know. The idea of these men meeting in a strip club had on the men in my life at the time. I was
right.
like,
right.
Gross.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it, I mean, it is gross, but it's also very funny that they are so unbothered by where they are. This is just where they meet. It's one of their offices. They're not.
I know. It just goes with the way that the women are thought of in this show generally. Like, not all. I mean, I will say the women are not written in an uncomplicated way, especially the main character women. But the way that Tony and his associates look at women as things is the part that makes me unhappy. And it's exemplified by the fact that they're in a strip club having business meetings with, like, naked women running around.
Right. Totally.
That growing up where I grew up, the fact that they filmed that at Satin Dolls was just such... was such a thing. We were like, Satin Dolls, really? Oh god. It's like, because it's the strip club on 17 in Lodi that, like, you drive by I got my driver's license in Lodi right by there, like, you know, there's a bagel shop right there that I used to stop at, like, that shop right was disgusting, that's right next to it, like, it's just, it was such a weird gross
location scouting. Then they nailed
they did. I know, but it's like, I don't know. There's something about, like, we talked off mic about how the scene where Tony hits the guy with the car actually takes place at an office park in Paramus. And, like, these are places I spent the first 23 years of my life constantly. Right. But for some reason, the fact that they picked a strip club in Lodi, everyone I knew was like, they're at Satin Dolls. Like, it was such a huge deal in, like, a weird way. But, yeah, that office park in Paramus... I saw it and I think I said this to you. I was like, at first I didn't realize that it actually was that one because they all look so similar. But it's actually, then I saw the street sign. I was like, oh, Mac Drive. Yeah. Sorry. I could just talk about the locations.
Well, again, this is world building.
Yes.
So.
We're talking about world building.
So we believe it. What's the hook?
Oh my goodness. A mob boss goes to therapy.
Right.
Like, yeah. Mob boss goes to therapy. His wife is sort of like clearly aware of what he's doing. That's another bit that I feel like is a bit of a hook for me, is like the Carmela Tony relationship, even though it's kind of a small piece of the pilot. There's enough there in their interactions for me to be like, oh, wonder what her role is in all this. But
yeah,
it's mainly mob boss goes to therapy, you know, has panic attacks, loves ducks.
Right. Loves ducks. He loves them. Man, that's such a save the cat. It's so obvious what they're doing with those fucking ducks. And it works perfectly for me. When he, like, gets in the pool with them and he's like, and if you don't like that ramp in his robe, if you don't like that ramp, I'll build you another one. It's just, oh, God.
I know.
A tender mob boss is all, like, it's...
Yeah.
for me, that's perfect. I'm looking at the taglines on IMDb, which is not the same as the hook, but Joe's just curious to see. And season one, it's Tony's not like other fathers. Tony is a mob boss, which is not great. I think it should be like Tony's like other fathers and he's a mob boss.
Right.
Or meet Tony Soprano. If one family doesn't kill him, the other family will.
Oh,
which is kind of funny. That's kind of good.
Oh, boy.
That's kind of good.
Yeah. I mean, it's the juxtaposition, right? It's the juxtaposition of this guy that you see running somebody down with a car and then, like, feeding ducks at his pool and kissing his son on the head because it's his birthday and, like, you know.
Being very sweet and tender with his family in some instances.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, the relationship between him and Meadow is super interesting as it develops. Like, she's very one note in this first episode, and it does not stay that way.
I have little patience for an angsty teen, even though I know I should have more. I know. But, you know, it's, and I'm sure I'll come around on her the same way I did Callie, who I love so much and would take a bullet for now.
Right.
But
exactly.
But it is hard for me in the beginning. That very short scene of her and Tony in the church that they're, like, great whatever's built.
Yeah, her great grandfather.
Yeah, I loved that scene. I loved that scene so much.
Well, and, you know, I don't know how far we want to get into this, but, like, this show has been touted as, like, anti-consumerist, anti-capitalist. Mm-hmm. And there's this contrast between, like, what his ancestors built, which is, like, an actual physical space of worship, and like what he's built,
right,
which is like only about money and and any means necessary to get it. So but I love the scenes between him and Meadow, and there are more of them like that where I feel like you see that she is getting older, realizing what is actually going on in her house and trying to negotiate that, and like her, the fact that she loves her dad clearly, like, you know, you and I talk about dads endlessly because I think we both had like kind of special relationships with our dads and difficult ones maybe with other people. And so there's definitely something there that draws me in as well. Like I want to see him be a dad more than I want to see him hit people with cars usually.
100% If this were a show about a mafia don and we never saw him do any mafia business and it was all behind the scenes,
which would totally defeat the purpose of the show, but which is getting us to love someone who does horrible things.
Right. But I think I would still love it.
I mean, you know, the whole point is to make it hard for us to love him, I think. But yeah, I mean, also, I know I keep coming back to the locations. That house is the perfect fucking house. The McMansion-ness of it, the like plasticky nature of everything there. Yeah. The contrast between, so what I was saying about the capitalist consumerist part of it, the contrast between his house and that church,
right? Totally, yep.
Like the religious iconography in the house is there, but it's like, it's the plastic Madonna statues that like everyone we grew up with had, and like, you know, the...
As opposed to this handmade marble.
And the stained glass. Yeah. Yes. Yes. The Last Supper. All that stuff. Yeah. That contrast I think is incredibly intentional.
You know what? I was just thinking about visually, I guess this is world building. We talked about the color palette in 6 Feet Under last week, and I was saying it's not saturated. I kept saying that word, and it's definitely not. Sopranos, so much of it, like when they're in those restaurants and stuff, so much of it is in shadow.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because one of the things about 6 Feet Under, from what I remember, is there's not a lot that you can't see on the screen.
Yeah.
And we talked about how matter-of-factly they handle death in that show. So it makes sense that everything is really laid bare 6 Feet Under. And I wouldn't have been surprised if that's also what the Sopranos looked like. But it does.
It's not. Yeah.
It's still very much part of the, it's like a different take on Godfather and Goodfellas and Casino and all of those kinds of movies. But but at the same time, it is still very much in that conversation, as opposed to doing like what's the word? I don't know what the word is, but it really wants to feel like it's part of that lineage, I think.
Yeah. And like, I mean, even in this first episode, the scene where Christopher murders Emil, the Czech guy, mm-hmm. like he is
email.
Right. He is fully in shadow to the point where we can't see his face mm-hmm. for part of that scene. Mm-hmm. And like that look of that, that type of cinematography, the extreme contrast between light and dark and like their faces being in shadow to the point where you cannot make out their features mm-hmm. like happens a lot. Actually, just sticking with the cinematography for a minute, I read something about how specifically this episode, it says, in contrast to the dynamic and dramatic shots that make up most of the hour, the scenes in Dr. Melfi's office are made up of very static, understated shots. The camera does not mm-hmm. evoke epic grandeur, but the quiet, thoughtful, intimate process of therapy. Apparently, Chase had a rule in production from the beginning that there would be no camera dollies or push-ins during the therapy sessions because it would indicate to the viewer to pay attention now because what's being said is very important. But instead, this was a Terry Gross interview. He tells her that psychotherapy in real life is far more ambiguous. It's not easy to recognize what is or isn't important during a therapy session. So the cameraman must reflect this ambiguous nature of psychotherapy.
Very cool. Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
So also, beginning with shout this out first... Terry Gross recording in Philadelphia, which is part of South Jersey. So that's my South Jersey reference for the week.
Okay. Okay. And this is the thing we're doing
Studios.
Now?
Yep.
Okay. But they said, beginning with this first hour, we see that the camera is used in many ways, but always in a way that best serves the needs of a particular scene.
Cool. I love that. That's a really cool, intentional way to be thinking about that.
Yeah.
Good find, exactly. Jody. I love that.
Exactly. I mean, you know that to me, the cinematography stuff is super fascinating, mm-hmm. like the color grading and the way things are shot. I feel like in this episode and in the rest of the series, there's a lot of scenes where things are obstructed by other things or other people. Like mm-hmm. you kind of are constantly feeling like you're not getting the full picture. Like you're trying to look around corners or look behind people to see what's happening, mm-hmm. you know? Like, even in the scene where he's running that guy down with the car, like, you're behind a tree and you're behind mm-hmm. a person. And, like, there's constantly interference between you and what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm. My biggest laugh in this episode was really big. Like, was, like, I had to stop for a second. It's, mm-hmm. like, exactly my kind of my kind of stupid humor. When they go to throw that body into the dumpster. And they miss. It's not even close.
Not even close.
They just like slam it so hard into the side of that dumpster.
Right into it. Right into the dumpster.
Oh man, it's really
good. It's
so good. It's really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love how kind of hapless some of them are throughout this whole episode. That's always funny to me.
Well, and that's also kind of the pilot setting up things for later. Like Christopher being such a big part of this from the beginning and being.
But having a little bellyache.
Having a tummy ache.
His and mom also, saying he probably shouldn't have even gone in today.
I know. But also the fact that like his haplessness and his poor like work ethic and all of that and sort of being somewhat incompetent some of the time is a huge part of like his storyline and the connection between him and Tony and like, you know, that continues. I think that's what I meant when I said like this pilot gives you everything almost that you'll need to understand the rest of the series. Like mm-hmm. you see Christopher and Tony's relationship. You start to see the other guys Tony works with, not in great detail, but like you start to get a sense of them. You get a sense of his relationship with his mother, with Carmella, with his kids. Like everything is seated.
Yeah.
In they the pilot.
Do such a good job setting up Carmella. Kind of all you need from her is the scene with Meadow where she's like, she wants to go into New York to have tea under the Eloise picture and her meeting Tony at the hospital.
Yeah. And telling like, him he's going to go to hell.
Yeah, it's so, man, that fight is perfect.
I know.
It's like they do, you know, he's got all of this machismo bullshit stuff that makes him think it's okay for him to cheat on his wife, but it's not, but like she's aware of it.
Yeah.
Like all of that bullshit of it, but she's not afraid of him.
No.
At all.
Mm-mm.
And he knows that like there's nothing and like he's not the way he talks to her sometimes in this is really fucked up but she does not cower from him like
no
she's still but and she's there because she loves him and he loves her even though they're kind of terrible to eat like it's that conversation like the difference is you're gonna be the one like when you die you're gonna go to hell is brutal from a real Catholic like that
And the thing is, right before that, she says to him, they're talking about the priest who mm-hmm. comes up more than just this episode. She says, Father is a spiritual mentor. He's teaching me to be a better Catholic. And then immediately she tells him he's going to hell.
So funny.
So perfect. Yeah. Yeah, we get a sense. We also get a quick scene of Meadow at school, mm-hmm. which, you know, she in this episode, I think, is applying to colleges because episode 5 of the first season is called College. And it is actually, we talked about that gateway episode concept. Mm-hmm. That's the gateway episode they identified. Yeah. And I think that's accurate. But so she's looking at colleges in that episode. And so we're getting a sense of her as sort of pulling away from her parents and more of an independent young adult. And that's
she's
like
kind of right
direction.
That it's a big deal to go to Aspen. You should just let her go.
I'm so on the other side of it. I'm like, that bitch snuck out. And I sneak out all the fucking time. But like, yeah. I got consequences when I got caught.
I'm not saying she shouldn't be grounded. She's right. She knows she's grounded, but you got to let her go to Aspen.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
You could do both.
Yeah.
Does she go to Aspen or does it never come up again?
I can't remember. I think it probably never comes up again.
Right.
I can't remember because like the next major episode for me that I think of with her is the college episode. Mm-hmm. But yeah. AJ is not super established, but he does have his best line in this first episode.
I know that line. I couldn't believe that's in the pilot.
It's in the pilot. I know. It's so good.
So funny.
It's so good.
Right in front of the priest.
What, no fucking ZD
now?
ZD now? Ugh, it's the best.
Yeah.
I would say AJ is the one that we get to know the least in this, who is important and has actual like storylines later on. He's not just the like wise ass kid, but he's like 12 years old at this point. So I guess at this point he is the wise ass kid and they don't quite have him established as what he's going to turn into. All right. You want to talk about Silvio?
Well, let's save Silvio.
Okay. Do you want to talk about Junior first?
Sure.
Okay. The reason I want to talk about Junior is just because he is set up in this first episode as a troublemaker and he continues to be, and like his relationship with Tony is kind of central to a lot of the family conflict for a while. It also introduces Junior's relationship with Tony's mother.
Yeah.
And that is a complicated thing that I think is previewed really well in that one scene of them in the car when Junior says something might need to be done about Tony and his mom just like looks away and basically looks straight at the camera. It's a creepy moment because suddenly you're like, you think of his mom as this sort of hapless old lady who's kind of bitchy and like but past her prime, and then when she's with Junior, she's with her generation and her equal, and they're like not letting go of that.
And like past her prime, like you said, but there was a time when she was not, and when her husband, like, she's used to probably having a lot of influence. And
yep. And Junior also feeling like, you know, these young kids don't know shit, and like I'm not ready to let go of my power either.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's all I wanted to say.
I mean,
I just feel like it's important to mention Junior because he's such a significant piece of it going forward. We've got so many actual Jersey people in this show that it's like a lot of them are New York, but a lot of them are also Jersey.
Do you want to do a rundown of who's from Jersey?
I know don't you want because, okay. Well, I was so sad that so many of them were actually from, David Chase is from New Jersey. Let's see. I love, I said no, and I'm going to do it anyway.
Listen, this is your podcast.
James Gandolfini is from Westwood and then grew up in Park Ridge. David Chase is from, where is he? I have all these fun notes.
Palmyra. Vineland. I'm just naming South Jersey towns. What a scoop that would be if we found out that David Chase is actually a South Jersey guy, huh? Could you imagine?
He is not.
Hynella. Stratford.
Hynella. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Let's see, personal life. He went to NYU, but he is from, okay, he was born in Mount Vernon, New York, but then they moved to Clifton and then also lived in North Caldwell. So, yeah, he's Jersey.
He's real Jersey.
He's real Jersey. Yeah, a lot of them are New York, sadly, but the main ones are Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Like Lorraine Bracco is from Brooklyn. Michael Imperioli is also from Mount Vernon. Huh. Interesting.
Real Jersey.
Brewster, New York. Mm. Whatever. Whatever. They should all be from Jersey, but they're not.
Yep.
Edie Falco's from New York.
Side note, but speaking of Dr. Melfi, she feels so Jersey to me. I know it's because of this show, but even before I watched The Sopranos, I always think of her as a Jersey person.
I know.
It's just because I like her, so I want her to be from Jersey.
Yeah.
One of my other favorite scenes in this show, because it's just like, oh, that's so good, is when they run into her at the restaurant
and
immediately get a table.
It's
so real and so good and so like, oh man, I love it. I don't know why, but I was just like, yeah, that's it.
Well, and her date is such a dick.
Oh my God, he sucks.
I mean, that also is a little bit of setup for Dr. Melfi. It's like, she's not just the therapist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we see her on a date with this dick that mm-hmm. she's kind of like, okay. And then you see like her run into Tony and be all uncomfortable about mm-hmm. it.
I love when he tries to pull a little like what he thinks is like Tony, like sway or charm on her in the office. He calls her hun.
I know.
Then like you can tell he's gonna try to like, and she's like, Dr. Melfi, nope.
He tries everything in that moment when she asks him about being depressed to deflect. Yeah. Uh-huh. Like he goes from like flirting to anger mm-hmm. to like walking out. Like he goes through his whole list of like how he could react.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Their relationship is so, I mean, it's him and her, and it's him and Carmella that are like the center of the show, really, mm-hmm. to
That's
me.
Cool. Right.
To me. Yeah. What else do we want to?
Well, I keep bringing up Silvio, but do you know how he got the role?
I don't know if I do. I might know and have forgotten, but
yeah. So the story goes that like when the Rascals were inducted into the Hall of Fame, Steven Van Zandt was asked to do the induction speech. And I don't know why he did this, but he took I'm sending you a link, Jody. I'll drop mm-hmm. some in for our audience. And just you could skip to about 30 seconds in.
Some people may not realize it, but the Rascals were the first rock band in the world. And okay, over there in England, some guys were making some noise. But in the real world, in the center of the universe, New Jersey, the Rascals were the first band. The first time I ever heard the song, I'll never forget it, I was with my girlfriend at the time. Beautiful girl. Oh, you should have seen this girl. I'll never forget her, Loretta Gorgonzola. She was so beautiful. Ladies and gentlemen, Dino Danelli, Eddie Brigati, Felix Cavalieri, Gene Cornish, please. It is my honor to welcome to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and it's about time, the Rascals.
What is he doing?
He's just doing Jersey guy. He's just
That's so funny.
Big time Jersey guy, just like really leaning into it. And so David Chase saw this and was like, we got to get Steven Van Zandt in. He's got to do that guy. Like, he's got to just do that guy.
I mean, all of the characters, all of the actors that play Tony's associates throughout the whole series, not just in the pilot, but are just so exactly perfect.
Mm-hmm.
For their roles.
Mm-hmm.
They just are. I did want to shout out, maybe we can put it in the episode notes, this mm-hmm. article on NJ.com about James Gandolfini called When James Gandolfini Was Just a Rutgers Student from Parkridge, about how this editor from NJ.com like went to Rutgers with James Gandolfini. There's things that don't surprise me at all, knowing people who've gone to Rutgers. There's the quote, "We had a fight club on our dorm floor and would wail in each other with boxing gloves as the girls hurried past would look somewhere between disbelief and disgust." There was the time we were having a dart gun fight and I kicked the metal door to the room where he was hiding just as he was coming out. This is the crux of this article. He says, "When he came to, I took him to St. Peter's Hospital in New Brunswick to get his forehead stitched up and paid the bill. It was $25 and worth it just to see the scar on his head during all those close-ups on HBO."
Oh my God. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then the last part of it, this was right after he died. He's talking about he visited him on set one time. And he says, "The day I spent on set, I saw how he moved among the crew, joking, BSing, knowing everyone by name. He was an actor, but no prima donna. He was a Jersey guy, one of us through and through." So,
oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah. Little tribute.
It is funny. He's a guy that I just have such, again, never really watching the show, not being super into like this genre in general, but I still just always had such fondness for him. It's like, he does feel like one of our, he's on our Mount Rushmore, I think.
Yeah. Well, and listen to this. So like he was born in Westwood. His mother was an Italian high school food service worker who was born in the U.S. and raised in Naples. His father, James Sr., was an Italian immigrant who worked as a bricklayer and cement mason becoming the head custodian at Paramus Catholic High School.
God.
His father earned a Purple Heart. His father earned a Purple Heart in World War II and would often purchase car tires from a shop owned by Salvatore Travolta.
Of
John Travolta.
Uh-huh.
Their sons consequently became friends and would later co-star in 5 films. His parents were devout Catholics who spoke Italian at home. So
that's so.
He was also named the class flirt in his yearbook senior year.
Oh, that's
year.
Really cute. What a little charmer. That's what it is. He just,
yeah.
Like if James Gandolfini had taken his life had taken a different turn, you know what I mean? Like,
I know
he could have been doing, you know, this could have been a biopic.
Well, and he, you know, I don't want to glorify him too much because he definitely had like drug and alcohol problems and was apparently kind of an angry guy sometimes. Mm-hmm. But he also like was involved with veterans groups and PTSD like awareness and all sorts of sort of like wonderful things. Yeah. They had apparently did a very failed intervention with him at one point, the Sopranos team.
Oh, really? Oh.
Where he literally walked in and was like, "No, fuck this," and walked out.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well.
So kind of tragic, but also you know, I found another article that was what
I'm doing a little dive into this Travolta Gandolfini friendship, because even though I know they starred in a bunch, like you said, 5 movies together, a bunch of movies together, I didn't realize that wasn't just like, you know, whatever. My father, this is from an ABC News article right after he died. My father sold tires to his father, Travolta said today on Good Morning America. I was his inspiration to get into the business, he said. He would see pictures of me on the wall for movies, and he decided that he wanted to be an actor.
Oh.
That's very funny.
Related to that, like, I read an Vulture article that's just titled, it's a book excerpt, I guess, called You Don't Understand What This Is Doing to Me, about James Gandolfini's work as Tony, and the things he had to do, and the things he had to act, and things like that. It says the more audiences watched and praised Gandolfini as Tony, the more his personal journey became problematic. Jimmy had suffered from alcohol and drug abuse. In 1997, he was arrested for DUI. He had a rough time behind the scenes. But what a show, what a performance, you know,
Yeah, I don't know that I'll need to, questions. We got questions. What is the setup for us?
So I think for me, questions are big questions and small questions, right? Big questions, can Tony change? Does he have any remorse? Is he actually in therapy to become a better person, or is he just trying to find ways to allow himself to continue to be the mob boss that he is? That's kind of the big overarching right. question. Other like smaller questions, I think for me were like, I guess like about the relationships in the family. Like, it's not a question, but I'm like, I want to know more about Carmela.
Yeah, what kind of interests are set up for us? Like, what are we interested to learn
more
about?
Like, for me, it was a lot about Carmela. I forgot how compelling she is in this first episode.
That scene with her and Tony when he tells her that he's in therapy. He's like, I'm going to confess something or whatever. And he's like, what are you? She's like, I'm getting my wine into place.
Yep. And then when he tells her, she's like, that is very, very wonderful. She's just over the top happy.
She's so happy.
And then she does manage to kind of couch it by being like, well, it's not spiritual, like, you know, growth, but it's a start.
Right.
Yeah. What about for you? What are the things that are kind of questions it raises?
I think the family, the like lowercase f family, right, is the hook and the thing that I am more interested to learn about. I, of course, like want to know what's going to happen with the different dealings that they've got in the business. Like that stuff with Junior, like you said, when it's like, I'm like, oh, like, is his mom really going to, but again, that still comes down to
his actual family. Yeah.
I think I'm with you on this one. I think different shows you and I tend like will sometimes key or like, there'll be like a different thread that speaks to each of us sometimes. But I think with this one, we're pretty aligned there for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so too. I mean, I'm a sucker for like something that explores like multi-generational parent and child relationships.
Totally.
Like,
yeah.
It's like, how can that not be interesting?
And, you know, in a way, the mafia is a version of that, even the folks who aren't related. So it is kind of like that just blown up into, you know, you can kind of trace those interactions similarly. So that's kind of cool. Last little plot note that just to something on the table that we sort of talked about, but I want to drill down on a little bit that I just thought of right now is something I really loved and that made me the stuff with the restaurant, that whole like treating it like such a business matter of like, well, we'll just get I forget his friend's name, but
to blow it up.
But the one where they're like, we'll send him on a cruise.
Oh, Artie. Yeah.
We'll get Artie out of town. We'll send him on a cruise. And then it's his wife who makes that not be the case. And then that Tony's like, all right, well, then I guess we got to blow your place up. But it's still kind of thoughtful because he's like, well, no, you'll collect the insurance and nobody will have to worry about it. Just the like business mind of that. The ideal situation is he's just not there, so it can't happen.
Right.
But if he won't take that, we've got to do something else. But the thoughtfulness of doing it so that, like, Artie isn't implicated.
Right.
Like, I'm like, he's just, like, a kind of good businessman.
Yeah. They set it up as a faulty stove. I mean, he is actually a good businessman because when the waste management business is kind of failing, like, he comes up with new, like, healthcare scams and things sort of on the fly based on issues that he's run into.
It's like kind of impressive.
Yeah.
Like in a way that maybe I shouldn't be impressed by, but I am kind of like, you've got a good business head on your shoulders, Tone. Like,
yeah. To me, the least believable thing is that it takes that little persuasion for him to actually take Prozac.
That's true. Yeah.
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 But shout out to Zoloft, which also gets mentioned in this episode.
Yeah. Those interior decorating tips, they really work.
So. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I was worried for this episode because I barely remember watching the whole five seasons, six seasons, but I'm pretty sure I did.
Oh, it got six seasons in a movie.
It did get six seasons in a movie.
Uh-huh.
Oh. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of things we could mention. There's some things about the cinematography that I didn't bring up, like the first frame shot of him between the legs of the sculpture, like referencing The Graduate and like things. There's like lots of really smart directorial and cinematography things.
We get an eyeball shot. We get a close-up of an eyeball.
Yes, we get it. We get, and then seeing him very laying lost. Down from above.
Yep.
I totally caught that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also the fact that we basically start in silence. The first like minute of the show is very, very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not supposed to feed ducks bread, though.
Yeah, that's one of those things every time. Like, I no.
Mm-mm.
And I feel like Tony should know that. He should have, like,
he's
been
got
doing
his giant
research.
Autobahn book.
It's so cute.
I know.
Come on.
I know. Bird guy.
Come on. He's a bird guy.
He's a bird guy. It happens to all of us at some point in our middle age. You become a bird person.
Yeah.
It comes for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
I also love the shout out to Skeet Ulrich.
Perfect.
Yeah, I don't know that there's anything else that I feel like. Oh, I did want to mention, so we talked briefly about the sort of jaunty music that was playing as he's running down the guy in Paramus. Apparently David Chase regretted that music choice. He told someone in an interview on the commentary track for the DVDs that he regrets using it because he thought it was hackneyed and silly.
It is, but I kind of like
it. I know.
That. I'm all right with it.
He's so happy when he's doing it.
Yeah.
Gabriella sent me down here for the gabagool.
Gabagool, shwoyadel. It's a few of them. There's a few good ones.
He says fungal in this episode too, doesn't he?
He says,
when he's talking to Dr. Belfi. Dysfunction of fungal.
Yeah. It's, hold on. What are some of the... I'm a lodging all the time is one of them I wrote down.
Yeah.
The dream, very Freudian.
Yeah.
Oh, Hannibal. Hold on. There are a couple mm-hmm. good lines. I'm so sorry. And then we can.
Yeah, no. We need to do it.
Gabagool. when he's talking about your Uncle Junior, he's a good guy. He's like, but he told your female cousins. He told me. told them I would never be a varsity athlete. And frankly, that was a tremendous blow to my self-esteem.
Yeah.
That's like right. That felt like My Blue Heaven to me.
Yes.
That's like where like this pilot. I'm guessing the show stays very funny, but like mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you're still feeling more of the kind of farcical like ideas that David had in the beginning. But
I will say that Uncle Junior continues to criticize Tony's young athletic abilities.
Very funny.
Throughout
That's
the
really
seasons.
Good. What a good bit. A tremendous blow to my self-esteem.
Yeah.
His mom, Olivia, saying, oh, listen to him. He knows everything. When it's just her and Tony.
Yeah. Yeah.
The repeated he was a saint. And now that her husband is dead, of course he was a saint.
Oh, my God. I know.
I wrote down, so what? No fucking ZD now.
Oh, that's I forgot, too, that was in this first in the pilot. And when he said it, I was like, oh, that's right. It's here. It's right at the beginning.
Dysfunction, this dysfunction, that dysfunction. Mafangul is really good. You and I already talked about this. This is so minor. Nobody in New Jersey. Nobody in South Jersey. I thought maybe this was a divide.
I know exactly what you're going to say.
I thought maybe this was because Six Flags, Great Adventure is in South Jersey. It's the part of South Jersey that some of South Jersey... Like, it felt very north to me, but it's in Jackson. That's South Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
They call it Six Flags.
Nobody calls it Six Flags. That is Great Adventure.
It's Great Adventure. And David Chase, that's a miss because you're so Jersey.
I know.
And you seem really thoughtful about it. I wonder if they thought nobody will know what it is if we call it Great Adventure.
That's probably true. Like, because Six Flags is, like, the overarching, like, there's Six Flags everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
He probably did that for that reason. But I definitely was like, that's Great Adventure. What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I don't think Rico, we even knew that it had Six Flags ahead of it when I was a kid.
No, absolutely. It was Great Adventure.
Yeah.
Probably until I could read and saw that it said Six Flags, but it's Great Adventure.
It's Great Adventure.
Rico, is that your brother?
Yeah.
The writing in the show is great. I have it such is. A long list. I just, guys, today I have no room for the penal experience.
I know. That was such a good one. That was such a good one. I wrote that down too.
Or it's a rainy night in Lyndhurst.
Oh, I mean, I'm such a sucker for a specific reference
mm-hmm,
and the shot of the like Route 4, Route 208 signs and the like specific office park in Paramus. Like, I just, yeah.
And then the last thing I wrote down was I'm all Ajit all the time, because that's, yeah, I've heard him. That's, I mean, that like could be on the state flag. But Hannibal Lecter is so,
it's so good.
It's so unnecessary, but it's so, like, it's such a funny little touch. It's,
yeah,
that's what I mean about Tony. Like, in a show where his role is kind of like over the top, and the show itself feels kind of over the top, but like, he feels really real and specific. And Hannibal Lecter is such a good,
I know,
like, you know, David Chase knows somebody who called him Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And the thing about David Chase that I didn't realize before really kind of diving into this, because like, Chase is not an Italian, mm-hmm, last name, and I was like, who is this guy making an Italian mom show? Yeah, mm-hmm, okay. He was born into a working class Italian American family. His paternal grandmother had changed the family name from De Cesare or De Cesare to Chase. His dad owned a hardware store. Like, he's the guy.
He's a real deal. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
I love it. I love it.
I know.
I don't love it, but
one more line that I wrote down. Sorry. I know we're kind of at the end of that. The mom.
Oh, please.
The mom has so many good lines.
She's
but at
great.
The very end, she shows up and you just kind of quietly hear her say, "You're using mesquite. It makes a sausage taste peculiar."
Peculiar.
It makes a sausage taste peculiar.
The word peculiar, that's, again, so specific. She doesn't say makes it taste bad. She doesn't say makes it taste weird. Peculiar.
Yep. Yep.
And it's the first and only thing she says to Tony.
Yeah.
In that moment.
Everything,
like, that's her greeting.
She says is a criticism of him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, very real. Very real.
Yeah. Exactly. The way she's like, she says things like, wait, there's a couple more of her that I loved.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to. Where are we? Mom's house. You'd think I'd answer. It was dark out.
That back and forth is such a,
I know,
aging mom, aging parent child relationship.
Yes.
Where he's like, I understand not driving, you know, not going out at night, but
yeah, I don't drive when they're predicting rain.
Yeah. Yeah. That's when I knew my dad was old, when he stopped, when he was like, I don't drive at night.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh
yeah.
What do you mean you don't drive at night?
Yep.
You're
exactly.
Your dad.
Yeah. No, I know. That's why it felt so like, that's why I said, when the mom, I just have, I'm like, oh God.
Yeah. She's tough.
She's tough. Yeah. My mother told me I shouldn't even come in today. We talked about that one.
So funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and then at one point, Hunter, the friend of Meadow, who's played by David Chase's daughter, actually, says, how do you stay so skinny, Mrs. Soprano? Like,
yeah.
It's a very, like, 90s Jersey mom thing to be very proud of, mm-hmm, still being fit.
Mm-hmm. Feeding everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
There is a giant pitcher of milk on the counter that turned my stomach. That is, what are we doing? Why are we pouring? What's going on there?
I drink a lot of milk growing up.
It just in a big glass pitcher?
In a carton in the fridge.
I was like,
with a missing
so
child
milk.
On it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's so much milk. We got a little You've Got Mail.
Yes, the AOL.
Uh huh.
The old computer.
Yeah.
When I had like basically that exact setup when I was scanning my old negatives over my break, I found one of the, like, a scene from my bedroom.
Exact
setup.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good. All right. Well, I guess that wraps up The Sopranos. That was easier and better than I expected it, mm-hmm, to be.
Yeah.
I was really worried. I keep saying that, but I was. I just didn't want people to be mad at us.
No, but I also think, like, I mean, it's, you know, considered one of the greatest shows of all time. So I'm not surprised that we found some stuff to like about it, despite some problematic issues. So.
And I feel like my inability to retain information in some ways is bad, and in some ways allows me to, like, re-experience things and be like, oh, wait, I did watch this and it's good.
Yeah.
So what are we doing next week, Andrea?
Well, we've got these little, like, mini series.
Right.
That we've kind of planned out, right? So I think Lost, yeah, 6 Feet Under and Sopranos are, like, tonal inspirations, maybe? Is that how we'd...
I guess. I think it was also time period and also like, yeah, the type of early epic prestige TV show.
Right. There we go. Early epic prestige TV show, I think, is exactly right.
Like big world building, like all of that stuff.
Yeah. I think I was wrong when I said vibes, because I think actually what we're getting into now is vibes. Right? These are shows that plot-wise, I wouldn't say have a lot in common with Yellow Jackets. These are shows...
Well, there's some references, at least this first one.
There are definite references.
Yeah.
And we'll get into each one. I think as we work through these next three, it'll become kind of clear how we chose these together. So we'll just give the first one. We're watching Twin Peaks, the first episode.
Yay! I'm excited.
I'm really excited.
So were you a Twin Peaks head?
No. It was a little... I think X-Files was the first show that I really latched on to.
Okay.
And Twin Peaks is a few years before that. I was only four.
Shut up.
I was
Shut
four.
Up. Shut up. Shut
years
up.
Old. So, you know.
God, that's horrible. Okay.
I've never watched the second season, by the way.
I don't know if I did either.
It's a show, because I have such a bad habit of binging something, like I have watched the first season a handful of times and then forgotten to pick it back up. And then I have to go, and Twin Peaks is not a show you just pick back up where you left off.
No.
And so I've gone back. I've watched this pilot, not in a few years, but I've watched this pilot three or four times probably at this point in my life. Yeah, what's your relationship?
So I watched the first season. A lot of my friends were super into it. I was into it, but I wasn't obsessive about it like some of my friends were. I followed it with interest. I watched it. I don't think I watched past the first season. I will say Stick the Landing, the podcast that I keep bringing up about finales, did cover Twin Peaks recently. And I listened to that, which was interesting to hear it from that perspective and like how it changed over time. But I'm really curious to see the pilot again, because I don't think I've seen it since the 90s.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah.
Pilot episode also known as Northwest Passage, ABC. Sunday, April 8th, 1990. It's Mark Frost and David Lynch, of course. David Lynch directed. And it's an investigation of a... If you've never watched the show, to just say, oh, it follows like the investigation of the death of a high school student, Laura Palmer.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
there you go.
What did you say the date was when the pilot premiered?
April 8th, 1990.
April 8th, 1990. I was 14.
And I was
four. Wow. Yeah. So I'm excited. It'll be interesting to see, because for me, it's like, this is one of the furthest back. This might be the furthest back we've gone. I don't know. Is it
for shows
in
for
time
TV?
Frame? Yeah.
Not for movies, but for TV. For
yeah,
sure.
That's what it is. Yep. For TV. So yeah, this is going back to like high school for me, like early high school.
Yeah, this is the first one where if I wasn't watching, it's because I wasn't aware. Like, you know what I mean? Everything else. There are a couple in here that I've never watched coming up, but
yeah,
not because I was too young.
This was a big hit amongst my specific friend group in high school. I had a friend named Eve who was full on obsessed with this show. Like, it was all she talked about for a long time.
I'm certain that if I were 10 years older, this show is so up my alley.
Yeah.
And it's influenced so much of what I love since, you know, of
yes.
course.
Would you say even that it is extremely your shit?
I would say that this show is probably extremely my shit.
I thought so. All right.
Want to let folks know where they can find us?
Sure. They can find us on Instagram at WatchersPodNJ. They can send us an email at WatchersPodNJ@gmail.com. And they can find me on Instagram at Jodi_Mim, JODIE_MIM.
And I'm at AQ Andrea Q. That's me. I guess we'll see you in the lodge. Is that right?
Yeah, we'll definitely. Yeah, that's the one. All right. Well, we will see you in the lodge. Love you, mean it.